A few of us just spent the last hour continuing the discussion of the nature and importance of art. It's an ongoing conversation, and it's appropriate this conversation be ongoing during those weeks when we're looking at the literature. That connection between the faith and art has always been a difficult topic. Ask Palestrina. This is something that's been ongoing throughout church history. It's an important discussion. It's something worth talking about. I want to take a few minutes before I get into what I intended to do to talk about that in the Purgatorio. This could be fertile ground for this afternoon's discussion because it's a very important question. It is of some interest, I think, that the Purgatorio is loaded with artists. Loaded with artists. Many, now of course we met some in the Inferno, but there are many more here in the Purgatorio, and quite beyond that, art itself plays a role in the Purgatorio. But Dante, being a complex thinker, gives us different visions of art even as we begin climbing the mountain. In fact, from the beginning of the work, it is announced. I go back to the opening of the first canto. He's going to sing about that second realm, and here death's poetry will arise to life. So that the poetry itself, he's aware of himself as poet, he's aware of his own art as he begins to write the Purgatorio. Probably more aware than he was in the Inferno because he has been through that. There is some measure of clarity in his mind now. He's going to focus more on his art. Please notice if you're reading the Paradiso this week, getting ready for next week, art becomes even more important, but what he's going to talk about in the next section of the work is his own role as artist, giving the description of what he sees, so that there is a different approach to art. But in the Purgatorio, turn if you would to the end of Canto 2. In Canto 2, the ship of souls arrives on the shores of anti-purgatory. Those souls that are going directly to heaven still have to arrive there, and they get to go very quickly up the mountain. Since they don't have to spend time in purgatory, God's love pulls them right up into the Paradiso, but they still arrive on the banks, on the shores of this place. And when they arrive, Dante runs into a friend of his that he knew who was named Casella. We begin with the arrival of the souls who are singing together. They were all singing with a single voice in Exitu Israeli de Egypto, which interestingly is the verse that I spoke of last time that he uses to explain the nature of his own art throughout the whole Divine Comedy, the levels on which that single biblical verse can be read. And then he meets an individual singer, the poet Casella, the musician Casella, who set one of his earlier Dante's, one of Dante's earlier secular poems to music. Dante is delighted to meet him there, and he asks this musician, "Pray sing and give a little rest to my poor soul, which burdened by my flesh has climbed this far and is exhausted now." Now, I go back to what Aquinas said. Aquinas said that the soul needs diversion, just as the body needs rest. Now Dante is speaking in terms of the soul being burdened by the flesh, which needs some lightening, which needs some entertainment, and therefore Casella begins singing, "Amor che lamenta la ragione," began the words of his sweet melody, "their sweetness still is sounding in my soul. My master and myself and all those souls that came with him were deeply lost in joy, as if that sound were all that did exist. The art transports them." I'm at about line 117 at the end of Canto 2. "But suddenly, and while we stood enraptured by the sound of those sweet notes, a sudden cry, 'What's this, you lazy souls?'" It was the just old man. The just old man is Cato. And some have been puzzled as to why Cato is this figure who's overseeing the entryway into purgatory. The translator here, Musa, makes the claim, I think it's probably a just one, that Cato was the lawgiver in Rome. So he's connected with human reason. He was the lawgiver, and we're entering into that realm of purgatory where things operate very much according to laws, orders, rules, even more so than before, and therefore Cato is overseeing it. What negligence to stand around like this. Run to the mountain. Shed that slough which still does not let God be manifest to you. Get rid of that old skin. Get rid of your earthly ways. Forget about, why are you wasting your time, Cato is essentially saying, sitting around listening to earthly songs. Even if the lyrics are by Dante and the music is by a very good musician, you're wasting your time. It's interesting. Time plays a very important part in the Purgatorio. And Dante is making the point that time is precious to the dead souls. Of course, the lesson we're meant to learn is they're constantly aware of time. How much time they have to spend in the anti-purgatory, how much time they can climb on any given day while the sun is up. Time is crucial to them. How much more should it be to those of us who are living? And again, the lesson is if those dead souls in purgatory are so concerned with time and spending their time wisely and are ordered by Cato himself, don't waste your time. Get about the business of climbing. It's a lesson for those of us here on earth to whom time should be, who should be even more important. Now, it seems to be a criticism of the art. Don't waste your time on secular art. It seems to be a criticism of art. However, we get through the anti-purgatory, and even as we're moving through, art has its place. Purgatory is filled with song. There is constantly the singing of the souls are singing. It contrasts with what I call the horrendous noise of hell. Hell is cacophony and terrible noise. But the purgatory is a place of beautiful music. And those souls, the suffering souls, are spending much of their time singing. They're singing sacred songs and sacred hymns to a large degree. Nevertheless, they are engaged in that activity. They are singing. More than that, we come upon art that is a part of the purgatorial mountain. I'm jumping ahead to Canto 10, very end of Canto 10, when we come upon the souls of the proud. And it's interesting to note, when we begin our ascent of Mount Purgatory, those who are most weighed down, you have to think of it in inverse order. The further down in hell we got, the worse was the sin. The graver the sin in purgatory, the closer you are to the base of the mountain. You have more to climb, so that pride being the worst sin, that those are the first souls we encounter, the souls of the prideful. They're at the lowest rung of the mountain. I'm at the very end of Canto 10. Let me start at the beginning. Dante comes to that first terrace of the proud, and at the beginning, he suddenly realizes that there are carvings, bas-reliefs, that are in the ground as he's walking and even along the sides. And what we are getting, they are pictorial representations of those proud souls who suffered for their pride, and then we get visions of souls who were humble, of humility. But what we are getting, lessons in the two extremes, from pride to humility, carved into the very rock. They are pictures. And the pictures are there for those who are climbing in order to teach lessons. We have to say, if there is a criticism of art in the Purgatorio, perhaps we can waste our time getting involved in it, but that is secular art. It was a secular poem of Dante set to music, secular music by a musician. There is praise for another kind of art, and that is the art that instructs. Let me put it this way. Let me go back to that dichotomy I gave last time. Two functions for art, to entertain or delight and to instruct. It seems as if the entertainment or delight side of art is lost in the Purgatorio. It is not as important anymore. But art as instruction gets elevated in the Purgatorio, so that the very lessons we need to learn can be taught through these images. Now, we get the bas-reliefs in the realm of pride, but as we climb upward, there are still artistic visions. In the terrace of envy, there are the disembodied voices who are speaking, and little lines of poetry and scripture. The reason it's not visual there, because on the terrace of the envious have their eyelids sewn shut. The poet says like falcons, okay? And because they've been envious of what they've seen, now they're not allowed to see. They are sitting there weeping with the tears coming from the eyes sewn shut. It's an incredible vision. And therefore, since they can't see, they are now hearing things. On the vision of wrath, those who are angry, they are given ecstatic visions. They're extraordinarily visions that are conjured up to them, but things to calm them because they have been wrathful in life. But all the way through, we have presentation, vision, sound, it's everywhere. It's artistic in nature. And he seems to be saying this is a good thing, and it is used in purgatory. Point I'm making, we get this double vision. Seemingly critical of art, the same time praising art is necessary. So that I would say Dante himself, to a degree, is exploring the subject of art as he goes through, as he makes his journey. We're going to get something very different when we come to the Paradiso, but art will still be a subject. I toss that out. Maybe we can continue that discussion this afternoon. I want to pause just for a moment to point out something else with the proud. They first appear. Let's go to line about 112. Dante speaks, I'm in Canto 10, line 112. Dante the pilgrim suddenly sees these figures coming toward him. Master, what I see moving toward us there, I said, do not seem to be shades at all. I don't know what they are. My sight's confused. The grievous nature of their punishment, he answered, bends their bodies toward the ground. My own eyes were not sure of what they saw. This is Virgil speaking. Try hard to disentangle all the parts of what you see moving beneath those stones. Can you see now how each one beats his breast? The vision of the proud is that the proud are doubled over. They are bent over. They are looking at the ground, which is why the lessons to be taught are in bas-reliefs in stone along the ground. That's what they're seeing as they bend over. And each one has on his back an enormous stone. It's as if they can't bend of their own free will. They're punished. They're carrying this enormous weight on their back. They're bent over. And as they move along, they're beating their breasts. It's an extraordinary vision. It's an imaginative vision. The reason I pause on this, it is a perfect example as to how the tradition, the Catholic tradition, is necessary to understand great Catholic art. Everyone in this room, because we are still lucky enough to have the Tridentine Mass, gets the image. What is the lesson being taught to the proud? The lesson is, you must humble yourself, you must bend over, and because you're proud and wouldn't bend in life, we'll put the stone on your back to make you bend, over you go, and now you beat your breast, and we have an image of the Confiteor. And it is a moment when that sacred liturgy connects with the art in order to give us the full vision of the movement from this world through the liturgy, and finally, the suffering of the souls in purgatory. They're doing it now because obviously they didn't do it when they should have done it. At that moment in the liturgy when they could have learned humility. They're being taught it now. If you have man, proud man, standing upright and just saying, I confess to you and my brothers and sisters that I was naughty, We've lost it. There's a whole level of richness in the art that vanishes, and it's a shame. There are a couple other examples of that along the way here. In any case, we have that vision of the proud. Okay. Let me move ahead now and get to the. I'm skipping over much. What I want to look at is the nature of love as it is defined in the Purgatorio. as I mentioned, cantos 16, 17, 18 are the center of the purgatory. They're also the center of the whole work. And it is there that Dante chooses to look more closely at his major theme, which is the nature of love itself. We can see examples of false love in the Inferno. We will have visions of the pure and perfect love when we get to Paradiso. What the souls in purgatory are learning about is they are being taught the real nature of love. And therefore, all the way up the mountain of purgatory, we are getting improper love somehow. The souls knew love. If they had not had some kind of understanding of love, they would not have made it into purgatory. The souls in the purgatorio are souls that have somehow known love. When we hit the depths of the Inferno, we met souls that did not know love. Satan had separated himself from love. And indeed, again, there's a reason why those who are there with Satan, Judas, Brutus, Cassius, were those who had betrayed friends and benefactors. Those to whom they owed the greatest love, they had denied love altogether and in fact gave something else, hate and betrayal. So that at the core of hell, at the center of the Inferno, there is no love. It's not known at all. But everywhere as we climb Mount Purgatory, there is love, but it is not perfect love. The perfect love that we will find in the Paradiso. There are lessons of love that must be learned. Here it is very simply. Purgatory itself, Mount Purgatory is divided into three parts. Okay? I said the whole of the Purgatory is three parts. The anti-purgatory, purgatory, and then the earthly garden, Eden. Now, the mountain is divided into three parts. And as we go up, we first get lower purgatory, then mid-purgatory, and upper purgatory. Those are the three divisions. The first three levels, where we encounter the first three of the seven deadly sins, pride, envy, and wrath, all have to do with love that has been perverted. It is love, but it's perverted love. And it's easy enough to see. Pride has been perverted love of self instead of neighbor. Envy, again, a kind of perverted love in terms of love either of what the neighbor possesses or wishing to be like what wishing to be in the position that one finds the neighbor in. And finally, wrath is really love perverted. It is a connection. It is an emotional connection with others, but not love, a connection through anger. But the first danger is that love itself will be perverted, twisted from what it should be. In mid-purgatory, when we get to the center of the mountain, which is the fourth level, we hit the level of sloth, okay? And it is defective love. It is love that is lacking in fullness. It is love that is so small and withered that it's not what it should be. And that is love of neighbor and love of God. On the level of the slothful, we meet both of those. And then finally, upper purgatory, three additional levels. It is excessive love. It is an overabundance of love, but again, love that has gone wrong. So, level 5, we meet avarice, those who have loved goods. Okay? It's an excessive love of material things. The next level, gluttony, those who have particularly loved food and drink. And finally, level 7, the lustful, those who have loved the physical in the world. Quite literally, loved their fellow men, but in a physical manner, and therefore, those creatures are punished. But they're the highest. It has been a love of others, it's been an excessive love of others, but they are at level 7. So we have three twistings of love, if you will: love perverted, love defective, and love excessive. in the center, when we hit, we're just about at the level of sloth, and then we get the discussions of love. I'm going to go through this very quickly. In fact, I may just be pointing out to you where to find these. I'm not able to go through them. I've got to get to Beatrice. I must. I owe it to her. Dante would want me to. Let me just say, at the end of Canto 16, at the end of Canto 16, he is, the wrathful are enclosed in smoke, blinded by smoke. As they were blinded by their anger, on that level they are blinded quite literally by smoke and cannot see, but he hears their voices singing the Agnus Dei in perfect, and they're singing beautifully. They're singing beautifully. One of the souls steps out of the cloud of smoke, and his name is Marco Lombardo. And he gives the first of the lessons on love, and it comes at the end of Canto 16, at about line 79, let's take it. We are talking about the God creating created creatures. We're talking about the beginning of love. Marco Lombardo gives the first lesson. It has to do with where love begins. You are free subjects of a greater power, a nobler nature that creates your mind, and over this the spheres have no control. So if the world today has gone astray, the cause lies in yourselves and only there. Now I shall carefully explain that cause. So we go back to the beginning. From the fond hands of God, who loves her even before he gives her being, there issues forth, just like a child, all smiles and tears at play, the simple soul. Talking about the birth of the soul. God loves that soul before it is even created. And the soul, the simple soul as it's created, issues forth from God like a child, appropriately enough. The simple soul, pure in its ignorance, which having sprung from her Creator's joy, will turn to anything it likes. And the soul is attracted to everything in the world at the beginning. At first, she is attracted to a trivial toy. And though beguiled, she will run after it if guide or curb do not divert her love. It's the image, those of you that have spent time around little children, especially heading into the terrible twos and during the terrible twos, is a perfect representation of that. Once the child can walk, and once the child can get a hold of things, the moment you turn your back, the child will go and get anything and everything. Nothing that is within the child's grasp is safe, because the child wants it all. If there is an external object, the child wants it and will grab it and will take it, which is why once the terrible twos arrive, everything in your home is placed on shelves at the very top, okay? Now, that is the image, and what is present there is a material fact of the child just grabbing and taking. Marco Lombardo says is true of the childlike aspect of the soul. The soul will love everything, take in everything, which is a mark of its simplicity, but he also says it's pure in its ignorance. At the beginning, the soul is taking all that in, but the way the ignorant child will grab that which is good for it, grab a piece of bread off the table, in the same way that in ignorance, the child will grab the bread knife off the table. The child will make no distinction between the bread and the bread knife. It's all there, it's all to be grabbed. Men, therefore, needed the restraint of laws, needed a ruler able to at least discern the towers of the true city. If that is the image of the pure soul that will grab anything, then there must be order. And law is important all the way through the purgatorial, from Cato the lawgiver, who's there in the anti-purgatory, all the way up through. Law becomes increasingly important. I'm not going to run through all this. But Marco Lombardo makes clear, and this is an obsession for Dante, that we were provided with two different lawgivers. We were provided with two different rulers as such. There were two restraints upon this undiscriminating, needy, ignorant soul of man that loves everything and will grab everything. And one, of course, is the church. The law of the church that is there to govern, and therefore would be able to control man, be able to control man's soul, and give the laws necessary to order that unrestricted love in the right direction, specifically in terms of spiritual things. And the other is government. And that meant specifically secular government, and for Dante, it meant the empire. A large political system that would govern and be the secular equivalent of the church that would govern spiritually, and the two were necessary. I have not spent a lot of time going through the political criticism that's in the Divine Comedy. There's tons of it. But let me point just one moment. Dante was aware that there had been an upheaval in his own time, and that was the weakening of the empire, the strengthening of the church in secular political matters, and as a result of that, also the strengthening of the independent city-states. And those city-states, as they grew stronger, caused increasing problems politically, simply because each city-state becoming independent became aware of its own power and began fighting with each other city-state. He insisted on the importance of the monarchy, and he wrote a prose work called De Monarchia, of the monarchy, but the vision of monarchy was all the way again up to a head, and that would have been the emperor. And the emperor's job was to rule over the empire, over those individual divisions, down to the city, yes, but the city could not be independent in and of its own. And that's what Dante had seen happen, and he was very critical of it. He talks about, in the Monarchia, the proper function of humana civilitas, civilized humanity, and the function is, this is a quote, to keep the whole capacity of the possible intellect constantly actualized, primarily for speculation and secondarily for action. That is, the empire exists, proper government exists in order for the intellect, each individual intellect, to be constantly actualized for thought and then action. Proper thought and then action within the secular realm. He saw that breaking down. He saw that order breaking down. He saw, if you will, a kind of inversion where the empire was crumbling, the city-state was taking over, and eventually, we can follow this through, the individual intellect becomes the source of all definition. In the same way, if you want to take it in the spiritual realm, we have the loss of the authority of the church down to individual religions, each claiming that it is indeed a true religion, and finally down to each man, his own church, his own priest. This process had already begun. Dante was aware of it, but please notice he focuses it in two separate realms, secular and spiritual, and in fact saw that the church was picking up the power that the empire was giving up and criticizes it. I'm in the same canto. I'm in canto 16. And in the midst of this, and it makes sense of the definition of the soul, love born in the soul, grabbing at everything, we see the love of the spiritual realm for its children grabbing power when it can, perhaps out of good motives, but nevertheless intruding into a sphere that Dante says is not proper for it. I'm at line 127. Tell the world this. We come up with this. Take a message back. Tell the world this. The Church of Rome, which fused two powers into one, has sunk in muck, defiling both herself and her true role. Her role is spiritual, the spiritual guidance of the souls entrusted to her. The secular realm, the empire, was to oversee in much the same way. with the similar kind of structure rising up to the emperor, the overseeing of secular souls, but now the church has taken over secular authority as well, is spending its time immersed in politics. This is the criticism made by Marco Lombardo, and in case we missed it, well argued, my dear Marco, I replied. Dante the Pilgrim instantly agrees with him. Good point. Yes, I'll go back and tell them that. I have scanted this in my discussions. This is also maybe something we can talk about this afternoon. That balance, what is the proper balance? Church, empire. We have completely lost the idea of empire. It's gone from us. It was crucial to Dante. Central in his writings. Central in his whole vision, and certainly part of the vision of the time in which he lived. It's so alien to us, we don't even think about it now. But it's an essential part of his vision, and it connects very much with what he saw happening to the church. That in some ways now perhaps we're the heirs of a long period of problems. Okay, let me go on. That's the first vision of love, the simple soul issuing for God, simply longing for everything. I move now into Canto 17. I'm going to jump to the end of that canto. Virgil is now giving the lesson. Please keep in mind, throughout all of the Divine Comedy, particularly the Inferno and the Purgatorio, Virgil speaks as the voice of reason. So what we are getting here is a reasonable analysis, a reasoned analysis of the voice of love. And where we have come at that moment, we have come to the terrace of the slothful. Those who were lacking in love, okay? Love defective by being inadequate love. And Dante is asking where they are, and I'm at line 86 in Canto 17. Where are we, he asks. Who are these people? What offense is purged here on this terrace? And Virgil replies, line 85, I'm sorry, Canto 17, line 85. That love of good, which failed to satisfy the call of duty, here is fortified. Okay? If it was defective, it's been given its vitamins now. The ore once sluggish now is plied with zeal. But if you want to better understand, give me your full attention. You will reap excellent fruit from this delay of ours. I'm going to teach you a good lesson, kid. Listen up. Neither Creator nor His creatures ever, my son, lacked love. First point, the Creator is all love, perfect love. Hence, His creation also must possess love. That is, nothing that God created has ever been without love. There are, as you know well, two kinds, the natural love, the rational. Natural love may never be at fault. The other may. Natural law is, again, that which is given, that which is infused in the soul that allows it to exist at all. The reason natural love can never be at fault is because if natural law were withdrawn, that is the animating power of God's nature, we would all cease to exist. That would be the end of us. If we were faulty in the natural love imparted to the soul by God, the end. We're gone. Okay? But the rational love, that is the love that we know and the love that we choose. Natural love may never be at fault, the other may, by choosing the wrong goal, by insufficient or excessive zeal. We get a definition, if you will, of the levels of purgatory. While it is fixed on the eternal good and observes temperance loving worldly goods, it cannot be the cause of sinful joys. But when, we're speaking of rational love, he calls it, but when it turns toward evil or pursues some good with not enough or too much zeal, the creature turns on his creator then. So you can understand how love must be the seed of every virtue growing in you and every deed that merits punishment. I won't continue there. I don't have time. But let me just say, there is the definition. Love is the source of everything in us that is good, but also the seed of everything that is defective. Because we are somehow turning away, changing, perverting the nature of love, and we are doing it by choice. We're doing it through our own free will. I'm going to rush on ahead very quickly to the opening of Canto 18. We're back to the creation of the soul. We're back to what is called natural love here, as opposed to the rational love in which we choose through free will, and we can choose correctly or choose or make the wrong choice. And hence, it's why it's very clear those damned souls in the inferno have chosen to be in the inferno. They had the potential. They had everything necessary to make the right choice in love, and they have chosen otherwise. It is their choice. So that God is being just in putting them there. I'm at the beginning of Canto 18, and I'm at line 16. We're still the slothful. We are about to be given visions of zealous souls, as opposed to the slothful soul. One involving the Blessed Virgin and the other Julius Caesar, a curious combination again. But in a way, what we're getting here is the counterpart of Judas and Brutus and Cassius in the pit of hell. And at this moment, we're getting our lesson in love, and we get them from those two counterparts. Okay? But not the one who betrayed our Lord, but the one who stood by the foot of the cross, the one who never deserted him. How could she? Okay? Being his mother. And Caesar, the emperor. Notice, the emperor, we're back to that theme, who was betrayed by Brutus and Cassius. I'm at line 16. Now focus your mind's eye on what I say, he said, and you will clearly understand the error of the blind who lead the blind. The soul at birth, created quick to love, will move toward anything that pleases it. We're getting a restatement of what Marco Lombardo said earlier in 16. As soon as pleasure causes it to move. From what is real, your apprehensive power extracts an image it displays within you, forcing your mind to be attentive to it. And if attentive, it inclines toward this. That inclination is love. The inclination toward that which you have perceived and given in your mind an image. Nature it is which is through pleasure bound anew in you. Just as a fire's flames always rise up, inspired by its own nature to ascend, seeking to be in its own element, just so the captive soul, captive in flesh, begins its quest, the spiritual movement of its love, not resting till the thing loved is enjoyed. The desire to possess that which is love, which first we can only apprehend as an image. It should be clear to you by now how blind to truth those people are, who make the claims that every love is in itself good love. Good love, bad love. Both things exist. They think this, for love's substance, probably, seems always good. But though the wax is bad, the impression made upon it may be bad. Love can be twisted. Love can be bad love. It's crucial. Now, I'm not going to pause for commentary. I've got to get to Beatrice. In any case, the central vision of the entire Divine Comedy is love and the nature of love. Those are the cantos where it's explored. They deserve close study, which I have not given it. I apologize. But the point being, Dante continues to rise, and what he is going to encounter is that great love that he was given on earth. What is going to happen for the rest of the work, the Purgatorio, up to the meeting with Beatrice, is he is now going to live through what is described here and have certain recognitions brought upon him. I'm going to jump all the way to near the end. I'm going to Canto 29. I want to look at the introduction to Canto 29 is what leads us to Beatrice. This is the last moment before her appearance. And we get this curious pageant. Let me just read what Musa says. It's a superb analysis. The pageant itself is very mysterious. I think he just nails it cold. This whole entourage comes in. And the commentator says here, the entire vision is a vision, if you will, of the history of Scripture in the church up until Dante's time. The seven candlesticks represent the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit. I won't go through them. You know them. The 24 elders who appear stand for the books of the Old Testament as counted by St. Jerome. The four creatures who come along are the four Gospels, and of course with the appropriate appropriate connections with the four evangelists. The chariot itself that comes represents the church. The griffin was a mythical beast that was part eagle and part lion, which means it had a dual nature. And hence the dual nature symbolic of the two natures of Christ, who is both human and divine. There are three ladies dancing on the right of the chariot. They're the theological virtues. There are the four dancing ladies on the other side of the chariot, who are the cardinal virtues. There are the seven men who follow the chariot. They're the rest of the books of the New Testament. And finally, the four men of humble mien who follow that are the other minor epistles. And finally, the final figure that comes in represents the apocalypse. Now, there's a moment later, and I'm not going to go through it, where the chariot goes through different stages. It's Dante's vision of the history of the church, including an attack by the dragon. And it is what you need to understand in looking at Canto 29 is this is what we're getting. We're getting Scripture and the church, the tradition of the church. We are getting the definition, if you will, of our sources of truth. And once that appears, then the procession comes to the halt, and the elders turn to face the chariot. The elders are facing the church. They begin singing, and suddenly through this rain of flowers, Beatrice appears. And it's very interesting. We have from the Song of Solomon, we have a hallelujah, we have a benedictus, okay, and then suddenly a line of Latin verse. Manibus odate lilia plenis, taken from Virgil. And Virgil is quoted in the Latin, a line that Virgil wrote in which he describes the death of the young child Marcellus. The cost of founding Rome is the death of Marcellus, the death of the child. The line when it appears in Virgil is a line of great sorrow. I'm in Canto 30, line 21. The line, as it originally appears in Virgil, is a line of great sorrow that comes out of the necessity of the death of Marcellus to found the city of Rome. The line appears here in Dante at the moment that Beatrice is about to appear, and what we have is the sorrow, the weight, and the imperfect vision of the classical world now transformed into the hope that is presented by the true faith, and the appearance of Beatrice in the poem. If Virgil was reason, Beatrice is grace, the coming of the life of grace. And as reason is replaced by grace, this single line of poetry is transformed from sorrow to joy. It's a magnificent moment. It's an absolutely magnificent moment. And Dante is so overwhelmed, he is about to comment to Virgil. He is going to say, not one drop of blood is left inside my veins that does not throb. I recognize signs of the ancient flame. I am being given this incredible vision of the history of the faith. He turns to Virgil, but Virgil was not there. Virgil doesn't say goodbye. At some point, reason is superseded by grace. We found ourselves without Virgil, sweet father, Virgil, to whom for my salvation I gave up my soul. And instead there is Beatrice. All the delights around me, which were lost by our first mother, Eve, could not keep my cheeks once washed with dew from being stained with tears. And at the moment of grace, he is overcome, the tears flow, and then Beatrice speaks. I'm going to read through this. This is magnificent. Dante. She calls him by name. Though Virgil leaves you, do not weep. Not yet, that is. Whoops. This is his beloved. Dry those tears now. Save them. You're going to need them, bud. Not yet, that is, for you shall have to weep from yet another wound. Do not weep yet. Please notice the coming of Beatrice. Please notice grace touching the Christian soul. It is not gooey. It is not sentimental. It is not smiley face religion. This is the moment he has hoped and dreamed for. It is the reason he took the journey. The presentation is magnificent. The flowers rain down. She stands before him and says, okay, dry those tears. You're going to need them later for a real deep wound. I love this. Notice the nautical image. Just as an admiral from bow or stern watches his men at work on other ships, encouraging their earnest labors, so rising above the chariot's left rail when I turned round, hearing my name called out, which of necessity I here record. I have to put it down. I don't like putting this down, but I have to because I'm a truth teller. I saw the lady who had first appeared beneath the angelic festival of flowers gazing upon me from beyond the stream. Although the veil that flowed down from her head, fixed by the crown made of Minerva's leaves, still kept me from a perfect view of her, he cannot see her clearly. It's through a veil, okay? I sensed the regal sternness of her face as she continued in the tone of one who saves the sharpest words until the end. Yes, look at me. Yes, I am Beatrice. So you at last have deigned to climb the mount? You learned at last that here lies human bliss. I lowered my head and looked down at the stream. But filled with shame at my reflection there, I quickly fixed my eyes upon the grass. I was the guilty child facing his mother, abject before her harshness. Harsh indeed is unripe pity, not yet merciful. It's a magnificency. It is the lover confronting his beloved, but notice what happens. That whole tradition of courtly love is now transformed into the child in front of the stern mother. The whole nature of the relationship is changed from child to mother. With all that implies, and what becomes clear now is Beatrice is no longer worldly, earthly love. She is a representative of the Blessed Virgin, the Blessed Mother. That's what he's confronting. He is suddenly confronting this woman that he loved, and she is different. It is not what he expected. As soon as she stopped speaking, all the angels rushed into the Psalm Inte Dominus Speravi. Okay? Now, I'm leaping ahead. She begins nailing him. Kaboom! I'm at line 103. I want to go through this whole long speech because it is Beatrice speaking to Dante. It is the voice of God's grace speaking to every human soul. At this moment, we all become the pilgrim if we have followed him in his journey, and this is superb. Again, it's the dramatic climax of the poem. If in the middle of the purgatorio we had the intellectual climax with the vision and definition of love, here we have the dramatic climax as the pilgrim soul stands before his beloved. And it's a surprise ending. It's a shock ending. It's not what the soul expected. It's not what we thought in our sentimental nature to get. With your eyes fixed on the eternal day, darkness of night or sleep cannot conceal from you a single act performed on earth. And though I speak to you, my purpose is to make the one who weeps on that far bank perceive the truth and match his guilt with grief. Not only through the working of the spheres, which brings each seed to its appropriate end, according as the stars keep company, but also through the bounty of God's grace, raining from vapors born so high above they cannot be discerned by human sight. Was this man so endowed potentially in early youth? Had he allowed his gifts to bloom, he would have reaped abundantly. But the more vigorous and rich the soil, the wilder and weedier it grows when left untilled, its bad seeds flourishing. There was a time my countenance sufficed as I let him look into my young eyes for guidance on the straight path to his goal. But when I passed into my second age and changed my life for life, that man you see strayed after others and abandoned me. When I had risen from the flesh to spirit, become more beautiful, more virtuous, he found less pleasure in me, loved me less, and wandered from the path that leads to truth, pursuing simulacra of the good, which promise more than they can ever give. I prayed that inspiration come to him through dreams and other means. In vain I tried to call him back, so little did he care. To such depths did he sink that finally there was no other way to save his soul except to have him see the damned in hell. That this might be, I visited the dead and offered my petition and my tears to him who until now has been his guide. The highest laws of God would be annulled if he crossed Lethe, drinking its sweet flow, without having to pay at least some scot of penitence poured forth in guilty tears. And the canto ends, the pilgrim is speechless. Speechless. Turn immediately to the opening of Canto 31. Without a break, she continues. No, but notice how it gets pitched up even higher. You, standing there, beyond the sacred stream, she cried, not pausing in her eloquence, and turning now the sword point of her words toward me, who had already felt its blade. Speak now, is this not true? Speak, you must seal with your confession this grave charge I make. I stood before her paralyzed, confused. I moved my lips, my throat striving to speak, but not a single breath of speech escaped. She hardly paused. What are you thinking of? Answer me now. Your bitter memories have not as yet been purged within this stream. My fear and deep chagrin between them forced out of my mouth a miserable yes. Only by ears with eyes could it be heard. A crossbow drawn with too much tension snaps bowstring and bow together, and the shaft will strike the target with diminished force. So I was shattered by the intensity of my emotions. Tears and sighs burst forth as I released my voice, about to fail. I'm running out of time. I can't go through the whole thing. They go back and forth, but he will not look at her. He finally begins speaking with her, admits to what he has done, okay? Those things with their false joys offered me by the world led me astray when I no longer saw your countenance. And she's giving him lesson after lesson after lesson. I am leaping ahead to line 64. She finishes her speech, and the poet finally gives this description. As children scolded into silence stand ashamed. There we get it again. He is the child, she is the mother. With head bowed, staring at the ground, acknowledging their fault and penitent. So I stood there. Then she, if listening can cause you so much grief, now raise your beard and look at me and suffer greater grief. He's not looked yet. Please notice what she does. She says, not raise your head, raise your beard. You're a man. You're a man with a beard. You're not a naughty child. You should know better. The very choice of words, again, humiliates him. With less resistance is the sturdy oak uprooted by the winds of storms at home in Europe or by those that Iarbus blows than my soul offered to her curt command that I look up at her. She called my face my beard. I felt the venom in her words. He still doesn't understand. And when I raised my head, I did not look at her, but at those first created ones. They had already ceased their rain of flowers. He looks at the angels that surround her. He still can't look directly at her. Then when I turned my unsure eyes once more, I saw that Beatrice faced the beast who in two natures is one single being. She's looking at the griffin. She is facing the image, the symbol of Christ himself. She's looking at the Christ image. Though she was veiled and on the other shore, he's not yet crossed over the river, lovelier now she seemed than when alive on earth, when she was loveliest of all. I felt the stabbing pain of my remorse. He looks at her and boom, it goes right in. What I had loved the most of all the things that were not she, I hated now the most. All those other things he had loved with once she was gone. The recognition of my guilt so stunned my heart, I fainted. What happened then is known only to her who was the cause of it. He looks at her, remorse goes into his heart, he passes out cold. Please notice, we're back at the beginning of the Inferno, when he is seduced by Francesca and so overcome with false pity that he faints. This is the second time the pilgrim faints, and it is brilliantly designed by Dante, in that the first time a woman speaks to him, she seduces him, she is a false love, he faints out of false pity. Now he is facing Beatrice, who says to him, you forgot me. You fell for false off the true path. And indeed, Francesca in the Inferno has been one. Suddenly he looks in the and zoom, real pity. He doesn't tell us about what he's doing. Ready, the two of them is at the beginning, operations. The seven P's are Paradiso by, from those holiest eager to rise, now ready for the stars. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. A week from today, we'll hit the Paradiso.